Hello, and a warm welcome to the Reform Party podcast. Today I have a very special guest, Mr. Alan Miller of Together. Alan, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Ken. Good to be here.
Good. Now, I think most people watching this podcast will know about Together and know what it's all about. But for those who haven't, would you like to just explain?
Yeah, sure. Together was set up 4 years ago when Boris Johnson said, we're going to have Freedom Day. And by the way, we're going to have vaccine passports. We created an umbrella organization. There were about 150 people that met at the time, campaigners, lawyers, citizens, a range of different people. And we put a petition together. There were six basic principles. One was free speech, had to underwrite everything. One, that there would have no more lockdowns. One, that we would have no vaccine passports. We didn't want to have a mandatory jab. We wanted people to be able to make their own decision about what they did. And children, we had a particular view on children. And we went out and we launched, basically, and we got about, for the Together Declaration, we got a couple of 100,000 signatures saying no to vaccine passports and no to papers, please. And then we got another 160,000 that we brought to Downing Street against a mandatory jab. We did a lot of work working together with frontline staff, NHS staff that had been working already for a year, who said they did not want to take a procedure. We'd already lost 45,000 care workers who were in that position. And so the Together Declaration was born from that. We were in the end successful at pushing back against vaccine passports and against mandatory jab for the NHS. And we then continued to work. Our basic premise, Ken, is that we want the public to be consulted and engaged with, and we want a strong public to be able to flex its political muscles and not be sidelined or scapegoated or ignored or just treated with contempt, whether that's to do with things like low traffic neighborhoods and you know, clean air zones where we're told one thing but never really consulted properly and ignored, or whether that's to do with banking and debanking, or whether that's to do with a whole range of issues that we've campaigned on, and we've won some things in terms of policy and we've made a big dent on some of the things in terms of lobbying and all of that. But our main goal is that we say that the public needs to be addressed and engaged with, and also we try and inspire and encourage the public to be involved in campaigns up and down the country, so locally, regionally and nationally. So that's what Together really is.
Good. Yeah, I mean, so this was when was it formed precisely?
In 2021, September, really August, but September's when we kind of formally went out to the world.
So really the COVID pandemic had been live then for about almost a couple of years by then. And it's, yours was one of many grassroots movements which came right out of COVID and basic and lockdowns, basically. What was your personal experience of COVID?
Yeah, well, so it's quite interesting because I come from hospitality is my background. So I did that for 30 years. And I did things around the world, and then in Britain and in London, I'd set up a place called the Old Truman Brewery. We did that for 20 years. It was very successful. The World Bank cited it as an example of urban regeneration. And then suddenly all these things happened to us, and I realized that the public were being discussed as though they were infectious and a problem. And this was quite some time ago, right? So this was in 2010, 2011, 2012. And in the end, basically after 20 years, I stopped trading there. We finished with our business and we set up a lobbying organization to represent nightlife called the Nighttime Industry Association. And that was very successful, as it happens. We did it for 6 years. I was the co-founder and a chair, and we got a lot of things done. And we spoke to the Treasury and the Home Office and the government, and we got them to rethink, particularly the police and councils. I sat down with them and I said, we've got to have a dialogue. You can't just shut down legal premises, right? You're going to have chaos. And that got listened to, and it was very successful. And I went around the world talking about it until lockdowns. And actually, in the run-up to lockdowns, and when Boris was the Prime Minister, we were still in dialogue, and they were asking, we were talking about keeping cities open and 24-hour options and how it really enhances our balance of trade and it's great for tourism. And we were sort of talking about ambassadors internationally. And then the shutters came down and I said, they're not listening to us anymore. And basically I ran a campaign called Open for All before Together, which was getting thousands of hospitality operators saying we would not have papers, please. Because in Wales, and they sort of introduced vaccine passports and they were trying it in different places and around the world, and they were looking at doing it. And so that was very brave of many operators to do that. And I'd been involved in doing that with some other people campaigning on other issues and going to demos, writing articles, challenging things. But what happened was I was like, listen, they're not listening to all these different individuals and groups. Doesn't matter how big your platform is. Doesn't matter where you are with things. And we, some of the people in the room were people that were like our kind of key people at Reform, and others, right? And it was people who had, you know, there were a lot of different people. And I'm like, some of you are very well known, but they're just ignoring us. And they're saying to the hospitality is an industry. I said to the hospitality industry, they're saying, you would say that because you don't care. You just want to make money. You want people to die. And I'm like, it's such an outrageous accusation, because hospitality people spend their whole time looking after people, making sure they have a good time, thinking about the local community, the impacts, ensuring their environment is good and their staff. They're very diligent and they're one fifth biggest sector in Britain, right? It's the thing that we bring the world to see and we do really well. And so it's deeply insulting and very wrong to start doing that. But that's what I did. I said, it don't matter what we do, right? That's what the message is going to be. So we need to link with other sectors, other industries, other businesses, but also people of faith, people that are secular, lawyers, professionals, and citizens. We need to not just be a trade body. We need to get the public behind this and involved with us. And even then, it's going to be a tough call. So my experience had been that they were using all sorts of methods to try and terrify people on a daily and nightly basis. And lots of things didn't add up from quite early days. Like, I did some voluntary work, giving out some food with some hospitality people, right? And I'm like, this is weird. You can get a pass to go and do this and you can give out food and people can deliver food and they can make food and you can have all these deliveries, but that doesn't pass it on, but other things do. And then I also saw how the airlines work, because I had to travel still. And there was all the mad things about a test before you go and the test when you land. And then you got to have a jab as well. And you got to wear the mask. But you take the mask off to eat. We stand up, sit down. We're like, you can have it. And we saw it all, didn't we, with the Scotch egg moment. And you have to sit up and stand. And then you can put your mask on, hands on head. Ludicrous, preposterous. And I think many people began to realize that, you know what the annoying thing is about, it's so outrageous and unacceptable, is that the British public are really very decent and they were willing to and prepared, firstly, to volunteer. So nearly a million of them did that. That was poo-pooed and put to the sideline. And then, and I really respect this, right? Many people were like, look, take this seriously. They're stoic and like, be sensible. And I get that, right? Because it was like, who knew what was going on? And that manipulation and that derision towards people and that just kind of, put stand in the corner, hands on heads, and like do as you're told, and constant fear, 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 and the science, repeating mantras is dangerous, because what it does, not only is it wrong democratically and it treats people with contempt, you then set up a situation where people become very untrustworthy and cynical about things, about everything. And that is a problem as well. And it's just so wrong. Came right. It's just so wrong how they treated people. I mean, everything from the police following people, throwing snowballs, to saying you can't sit together in the park outdoors, like drones following. But the sign, like the whole litany of things that we've seen, and particularly, and we can come on to talk about this in the digital ID stuff. But what we saw in the lockdown files that came out with the Telegraph, and then the Twitter files when Elon bought X, and all the things. That, you know, the lockdown files, the spy units that were sent to citizens and doctors and journalists, and how the files were kept on people, and you know, everything from Mark Zuckerberg to conceding that, you know, Meta and Instagram and Facebook were all used to shadow ban and censor, and they were like being pressurized by the Biden administration and by the secret, you know, by the services, the internal services there. And all these things that you kind of think, oh, no, you know, if I came in and wrote a script and said this had happened, you'd think, don't be mad, right? That's over, you're being over exaggerated, that's over dramatic. That would never happen. Like that. All these things happened, they were done. And they were done, and you're like, right, it was mad. It was, most of it was really completely unnecessarily, completely over the top, unacceptable. But the one thing I will say about it all is that through that treatment, which I would never, if I could stop it of happening, I would. But the thing that they, and this is as true for reform as I think for everything else. Now, obviously, reform have more history and going back, and obviously Brexit and what happened and didn't happen. But that government that was in power was only in power because of, you know, what happened.
Yeah. 2019, we gave them that huge majority of seats.
Exactly. And they had a mandate and to go and do some things and to be effective and do it. And what did they do instead, right? It was insane and unacceptable. And that's why they've been so punished. And I'm not sure they're going to recover from that. And nor should they, in my opinion. And here we find ourselves.
Well, people say to us, you're very cruel trying to destroy the Tory party. And I say, no, we're not. We're getting what they deserved. I mean, that period from 2019 through to 2022 was absolutely horrific. And I have to say, I wasn't at all surprised that the government would try to use the pandemic to exert control over the population. That's what governments want to do. That's what they try to do. What I was astonished by was that the population would look at something as irrational as saying you can go and have a meal, but if you want to go to the toilet, you've got to put a mask on while you walk there. I mean, just that sort of irrationality. And there was hundreds of examples of that kind of thing. And people went along with it. They know that, oh, yeah, I'll do that. I'll put my mask on when I stand up. Just nonsense.
I like to bend the stick towards the unacceptable nature of the people in leadership and positions of responsibility. And I think that the British public, the great British public, are really decent and they give people the benefit of the doubt. And we've kind of, the reason why we don't have raging street battles all the time on the way to work and things like that is because people are a decent bunch. And I know that people are frustrated with what happened. But I will say that now, again, if you look in the last couple of years at how the mainstream press and many of those in power and the elected talk about the public. The public's ahead of everyone at this point. They're like, the amount of times you've called everyone racist or far right, whether it's if you're challenging ULEZ or low traffic neighborhoods, or whether you're voting for a new political party like Reform, that those slurs, on the one hand, they walk off a duck's back, but it's also the case that many more people are sick. This is not once in a lifetime pandemic that most people don't really understand and don't know about, right? This is, I want to talk about borders, or I want to talk about my country or my culture, and you're just calling us names. This is not okay, right? It's not, oh, if you don't do this, your neighbours might die, right? It's a tricky old thing, that thing, right, that happened. And I give my fellow public the benefit of the doubt, right? I also, you know what I mean, it's like, because there was a bit where I think some of the particularly older people were nervous and there were people with conditions, and there's a bit like, you know, some people just never want to follow any kind of instructions, and there was a bit of that, the stoic British, and so I want to be a little careful about that stuff. But I think also fairly after a while, things fell apart from them. They realized it couldn't just, and also the marches and the demos, if you it got bigger, and we won some things. Right? In the end, we won the fight against the vaccine passports. We won the battle against the jab mandate. And as soon as that was done, and we were told by friends in Canada and Australia, they said, well, good luck, but we don't think you're going to win that. It was a very different perspective then, right? It went right up to the bone. But as soon as that happened, everything changed, right? And so the thing is, there were enough people who did stand up, and they were people who'd never been involved in politics. You remember the demos, the bigger anti-lockdown demos. It was astonishing. It was like people seeing people from who'd never been involved in politics, who'd just be from like your neighbours from down the road, and they all came there. And the name-calling and all this thing couldn't work anymore. And I think since then, we've seen even more of that, right? We've seen that so many millions of people, they tried it with Brexit, and they tried to kind of smear people and call them names, and they never learned the lessons, the technocrats, right? They haven't learned the lesson in America, and they haven't learned their lesson in Britain, right? And now they've wheeled it out again at the Labour Party conference, right? So it's very disgusting, because they're saying, well, we don't, yeah, we like the British flag as well, but we don't like those on incite racial tensions and violence. And you're like, but you're inciting racial tension. You're inciting, no one else is doing that, right? You're doing that. You're asserting it all the time at the Labour Party. And actually, the public see it all, right? And I think it's far less easy to flannel the public around things that on an everyday basis that they know, and you call them all these things, one guy like neo-Nazis, fascists, and you're like, no, this isn't working. So I'm quite optimistic about the skepticism and the level of where the British public's got to. I think it's very good news for reform, as you can, you're, we're seeing with the membership numbers and things like that, right? And that will mean all sorts of things, and it will also mean every, you know, people will have expectations, as they should do, and it will mean that there's a lot of new people. I know you guys have got in council positions, and new council elections coming up in May, and then the general election. It's all going to be an exciting time. It's a very exciting time in politics. Also, new other parties that are coming, not just in what people might say the centre-right, but from on the far left. And all these things are going on, right? The centre, the old ways of doing things are going, yeah. They're crumbling. And it's exciting, but it also is going to mean that we're going to have to really think about things. We're going to have to all be responsible and accountable. And that's what we're passionate about together, that with the public and the grassroots and people on the ground, that everyone, we don't just think, oh, someone else will sort that out, someone else will take care of it, is that we recognize that whoever's standing, we all have a duty and a responsibility to kind of keep everything accountable. And so when Boris says, I'd eat my ID card if ever one comes, and then he's then in power, he's saying, you're all going to need an ID card, we're like, no, and not allowing that to happen, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that came out of those 2 or 3 years was the fact that people became aware of how much the media were responsible for manipulating the truth. I mean, I remember you talked about these, I went down to one of the marches in London for anti-COVID, anti-lockdown marches, and there must have been a million people there. I mean, it was absolutely massive. We walked right around London, and, you know, the I think, you know, 25 deep, where it just went on for hours. And I came back and I sat in the window of a pub opposite the end of Downing Street, and I looked out, and there was about 2 or 3 deep, you know, around the end of Downing Street, as it often is at demos. Then I saw 3 or 4 tactical support group vans pulled up. A bunch of guys got out the back of it, walked over to where the end of Downing Street, and threw a few things at the police. And then the police, you know, and so you go at that, the BBC news stand from around the corner came out, filmed it all, yeah. And what you got the next day was, you know, trouble at the demonstration.
I mean, yeah. So what we saw on a large scale was a daily, nightly ritual of theatre, of people telling people how many people are dying, never contextualizing anything, never saying how many people die of cancer, heart disease, strokes, generally. Saying that all of these people have died of COVID, whatever that meant, right? Was it with COVID? Was it underlying issues? Was it exacerbated? Was it just of that? No autopsies, no real clarity on any of these things. And it was do as you're told, wear the mask, you know, hands on head, stand in the corner. It was like mental, and it was changing. Red zone, blue zone, yellow, you can go here in this place. You can't hire a place here. You can, if you go on like rentals at Airbnb or whatever it might be, you can. And the whole thing. Now, look, I get that when you, it's easy to be critical of people when they're in power, right? And if there's things you don't know. But one of the things is honesty. You can say to people, we're not quite sure what things are and how, but, and you can say those things. But Boris was buckled, right? But he buckled because his original position on this, he did a U-turn on, was to like just to have a common sense approach to it all. And he just, this man allegedly of principle buckled and he caved in. And this is the thing about also the civil service and of a lot of the kind of activists that are in there and the pressure that can come in. I get that if you're not a medic, you're not necessarily, but this wasn't about medicine or science. This was about policy and someone had to exercise political judgment, and he outsourced it and they outsourced it to everyone and they buckled under it. And it should have been done very differently. And so he had the press, mad campaign going on, right? Every night, death, 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 and not contextualizing anything. And then you must do this, it's always changing, right? Police following you down the road. Have you been more than 29 minutes? And like, you know, it's just crazy environment, like a Stasi-like environment, really insane. And then, right, but when people, I know those demonstrations were incredible to me because I've never seen those people. I've been involved in different political things for different parts of my life, right? And I've never seen anything like that. And I've never seen things that are so peaceful and calm and, as you say, so full. In fact, once Richard Tice took a helicopter up and he filmed the whole thing because saying like, oh, there's a few hundred or there's a few thousand there. And you're like, you have got to be joking, right? You're saying that's less than a kind of kids football match, right? And second division, third division. But like, we know what a few thousand people look like. This is not that, right? I mean, I do events. I've done events with, you know, 30, 40,000 people. We know what things look like, right? These, and so, and it was weird because once or twice or a couple of times, there was at the very end of the demo, there were a few guys, five or six, and you were like, where are they? I've never seen them for the whole thing of throwing a few bottles at the end. But what was remarkable was how well behaved everything was. Now, I think that that should, you know, it's like the dishonesty with everyone and the fact that so many journalists thought my position is not to be inquiring and investigative, but is to be tub thumping for more, longer, faster, harder, like the so-called opposition did, like the Labour Party did. And really, all of them are accountable and all of them are responsible. They should be held accountable. This COVID inquiry is not fit for purpose. But it's not fit for purpose. But the thing is, I think that's important, and is that so many people have seen through a lot of that. And I think it's also encouraging. Look, you see, like Nigel has said various things like from the start, people have changed and seen their position and seen what's gone on, right? He said quite some time ago, like, you know, we've been lied to about things. We were lied to about what was going on with the jabs. We were lied to. We look at the COVID vaccine passport. Very early, they were against that. I mean, Richard and everyone sort of supported our campaign. He was a signatory on it at Together Declaration, along with others. It should be said that lots of different people all got involved in this and did that. And I think that the skepticism people have now, and we'll come on to the digital ID now, that Keir Starmer's like favorite pet of Tony Blair is trying to push, you know, and is at an international event of all the big international things that are going on in the world. What he's chosen to speak about is digital ID and taking this Indian version that's been very coercive, that's been very leaky, very hugely problematic, and say, I want to take some of that and impose it on Britain. It was originally meant to be voluntary and it's compulsory. But I think that people have now seen a lot of things like these types of things, these podcasts and these discussions and interviews have happened much more as a consequence of it. Many more people aren't just looking to the BBC, although the BBC still carries a lot of weight with people, right? A lot of people look at it. I know when I do interviews on the BBC, we pick up new members and people that my family know hear it and listen to it, right? So people still listen and watch the BBC, and it's a national broadcaster. And it's astonishing some of the things that were on there and still are on there. And this idea of, you know, BBC Verify, the idea that you're going to have a kind of objective analysis.
I mean, I think most people will now agree that the mainstream media were complicit in what went on during the lockdown and COVID. How complicit do you think the NHS were?
So I think what happens is you've got NHS trusts, you've got different levels of what the NHS means, right? So I think there's frontline workers who are dealing with some things. I think there are lots of bureaucrats, which is a big problem, a big sclerotic management, which is a huge issue with the NHS, and that needs to get immediately addressed and resolved. A lot of ideology, things like DEI, ESG. And so there's activist type outlook in some things. And I think there's, the thing is, it's the big public sector, it's a huge employer. And it's kind of, it's entirely intertwined with the public sector now is dominated by, that is really what Labour has become. It's not about the labouring classes anymore or labouring people, but it's the public sector. That's what Labour's real relationship is with one or two other demographics, which we could talk about. But I mean, primarily that's that. So I think that with the unions and others, it was really interesting because we rallied with all the unions. We said, look, all of them, right? Unite, all of them, like GMB. We said to them, listen, your members have been threatened. Other people have been booted out of care. Some of them weren't represented by trade unions, but your members are now being threatened and you have a duty and responsibility. Are you going to come out and challenge this? And so what they did was very interesting. Without exception, they were very quiet for a long time. And then they began to say, we should have a pause on this, or we're not, you know, it shouldn't really, we're not sure. But they didn't unequivocally challenge it. They didn't massively come out and defend their members, except for the Workers of England Union. It was the only one that did it, right? And we worked with them. But the we spoke to everyone, right? The Royal Colleges of Nursing, the Paediatrics, the GPs, everyone, right? Paediatricians, like, and there was a recognition, right? And there was a fault line, and they knew this was a problem. And also the other thing is 100,000 staff, right? This was not going to not be noticed if they went from the NHS. And yet there was a, you know, that. So what happened? I think there's a thing. There's a number of different people and there's all sorts of stuff, right? Because I was always asking myself, well, how can people who've been so smart, like doctors for 7 years, they've studied. But, you know, doctors have done all sorts of things. Dare we say it? Dr. Mengele. I mean, I'm not being funny. There are doctors all around the world right now that are involved in all sorts of things. We know that there are terrorists that have been targeted and killed that have been doctors, right? So they have done some brutal, terrible things. And there are wonderful doctors. And the doctor part of being a doctor is great. But then, like anything, it's what's your political outlook? What's your attitude? What you're doing? And also, what's your orientation? Are you critical? Are you just getting things and not critical? Are you are you a GP which is administering things at some? Are you someone who's an epidemiologist, right? Do you really understand the relationship between these things, how these viruses travel, what this means right now, and at what point you can scrutinize it? And some people are very specialized and focused, and there's an overview on it all. I think that one of the things that's come out in the we've seen people like Professor Livermore and others talking about the problems in how things have been presented. We're also beginning to see that, like, many of the hospitals were not fully occupied. We were told all sorts of things. We obviously had all those nightingales that were set up. It's amazing how quickly things can be set up if people think they need to do it, right? But they can't cope with things like migrant hotel moment, or you can set up things really fast if you want to and then they don't get used, right? It's like, so all these things, like the Nightingale Hospital, all this stuff was done. I think that, you know, we just got to think about all the banging of the pots and the people dancing and they're doing videos. There was a lot of virtue signaling.
Yeah, the Nightingale Hospital was set up in order to be able to ventilate patients. Now, I knew, and my brother's a surgeon, and we talked about it back in 2019. I knew that if you've got a patient with a respiratory infection and you put them on a ventilator, 9 times out of 10, you kill them instantly. And yet they'd set up all these hospitals to have ventilators to ventilate patients. It was the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, yeah. And we saw that from Italy quite quickly. But look, this is where I'm going to... Look, I have never... I think tactically and strategically and from a plan point of view, we had a pandemic strategy and pandemic preparedness, and we threw it away. We jettisoned it, and for this mad set of things, right? So it was unacceptable. And in the midst of it all, and I was talking to some people in government at the time when they were doing it, and then the shutters came down, and it was astonishing some of the things. And so, they're not stupid people, right?
No.
But it's like what happens is that these things happen, and people start responding in a certain way, and they're under pressure. And I think that, look, I really think that the COVID only, the National COVID Service did a great disservice to people, right? What ended up happening is people who did have cancer, stage one or two, people who had, you know, issues with strokes and heart disease. And we said at the time, many more people would be suffering from all these things. There's going to be a huge backlog. And we're like over 7 million on a waiting list now, right? And it's not just that, but that was an enormous contributing factor. And so many of the other aspects we warned about, what it would do to children, what it would do to arrange, and we still haven't got kids back in school properly since then, and an array of different areas. And I think that there's this thing where people go in lockstep, and the NHS as a public sector is very, its orientation and its whole outlook is of a particular ilk, and that needs to get redressed as well.
But it's deeper than that, isn't it, Alan? Because, I mean, I noticed on your website that you're still in opposition to the end-of-life protocols that were introduced in the NHS during that period.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically, that was, in my view, quite largely responsible for the levels of excess deaths, because people were going in. I mean, I was unfortunate enough to spend 10 days in hospital on oxygen with COVID. And I lay there, and there was 3 beds opposite me, and I'm looking at the whiteboards up above them, and they've all got DNR on them.
Yeah.
And I'm lying there, and I'm thinking, I wonder what DNR. And eventually, it dawned on me: do not resuscitate. And then I turned around and looked at my own whiteboard, and it had DNR on it. Now, nobody had asked me whether I wanted to be resuscitated. Nobody had asked my wife or family. I mean, it was awful what went on.
It is outrageous. It is utterly outrageous. It is contemptible. Now, this issue, and particularly with the assisted suicide bill that's gone through and then out in ping pong with the House of Lords and back and forth and amendments. But the idea that bureaucrats just make a decision without consulting family or individuals, active agents, in like conscious humans that are individuals, the citizens or subjects of Britain, is so dangerous and so wrong. And we saw it far too much. And we saw the, I mean, like, it's difficult. Anytime I watch those videos or look back in it, I try not to do it too much, but they sometimes come up, just how outrageous everything was, right? And not just the playgrounds taped off, but particularly with more vulnerable people, our elderly people, people in care homes, how they were treated, this so-called nonsense they said about the ring of steel, and then, but what they did to older people and how they treated them and what that meant. And the DNA, they do not attempt to resuscitate. And the Liverpool Care Pathway, which was meant to be outlawed, which is still in existence, where you just basically starve people in a horrific way. And this idea that, and it's a technocrat's dream, right? This is the point I think you're making, which is that when you've got a world that thinks, well, net zero, too many humans, we're consuming too much, you're not much use anymore, you're old or whenever you are, get out of the way. And you've got technocrats or bureaucrats going, we need beds for the public service. The whole mixture of all those things, you know, coffin dodgers, we just like the horrible things that are said. The idea that you can make just be on a balance sheet, make it a bit more efficient and just go, right, wallop, they'll all got to go. And it is outrageous. That bit has not been addressed properly. We've been involved with other people like Hart and others that have done a separate people's inquiry on what happened, and with Amanda Hunter and others around the care community and the NHS looking at what's gone on and some reports that we've done, and particularly fighting back around the assisted suicide bill now and what could become an act. But like the idea that the state gets to sanction the death of citizens is something that everyone should be very, very concerned about, right? I mean, they should be very concerned about that thing. And it was, so we saw a lot of things happen that were really terrible. It's also how, through things like the emergency traffic orders and things, that's how all the low traffic neighborhoods were introduced as well, with surveillance cameras and bollards and this whole thing, right? Oh, we've got to do it now. Same thing, an emergency, climate crisis, we've got to do, well, hold on a minute, what you just mean we can't drive? Oh, you got to drive all in one area, not in another. There's no rationale to it whatsoever. It's just like, we're telling you that's what we're doing and we're doing it anyway. Green billionaires are backing it, by the way. People like Chris Hone and Mike Bloomberg, we've done a couple of big pieces of reports. People can see it, togetherdeclaration.org with Ben Pyle, where we've kind of seen how the green billionaires, they always talk about big oil and big money. They have specifically tried to take it out of Parliament, go for local councillors, local authorities, and get embedded there. They've got nonsense, non-grassroots movements like UK 100, so-called cyclist organisation, as well as things like the mayor's organisations around the world, which Sadiq Khan is a chair of, but C40 cities, all pushing the idea of 15-minute cities, these new smart cities that are all heavily digitised, heavily surveyed, limited. And they say, oh, it's all great, everything's, well, where is the GP that you can see, right? Where is the library? They're not, you know, that will come later. We're going to get the bollards and the cameras first. You get, all right, we're going to have Checkpoint Charlie and none of these facilities, right? And by the way, you haven't consulted or been honest with us. And then the people that did respond, you've ignored them. It's utterly outrageous. And I think that when we came out of the lockdowns and we've been through that period, we were trying to make this, but we were working with a lot of people around the country, you know, everywhere from Oxford and Bath and Bristol to Sheffield and Birmingham, Liverpool, everywhere around the country, Edinburgh, Glasgow. We've seen where these measures are. There's some brilliant people locally doing things, challenging it. But you could just see the reach and the way the state and local councils treated with contempt a lot of the public in the same way. And this is our central point, right? And it's particularly pressing with the whole digital ID, which some silver bullet's going to solve all our problems. No, it's not. But don't treat the public with contempt. In fact, all the benefits that we've ever had in the modern period have become as a consequence of ordinary, everyday people arguing and assisting, fighting for it, right? We didn't, nothing changed, right? As everything from the suffragettes onwards, you know, all those things were done because people stood up and said, this is what we want. It wasn't because really smart people generally said, oh, we'll do this and give it to you. And I think that that spirit, particularly in Britain, of so many that gave so much, of the Tyndales and others that like for free speech, and the, you know, if we think of Peterloo, if we think about some of the real, not obviously the Civil War, going right back to the Magna Carta, but the Civil War, Parliament, but also the two world wars, but at various junctures, Britain in particular has been so crucial to freedom of conscience, to privacy, to democracy and freedom. And this is the battle of our lives. I mean, obviously you guys are organizing and doing things, and you're, you know, that's what you're doing. We're also doing that. I mean, it didn't take the form of a political party, but this is the, in it, and it, and we should all recognize it's not going to go without a big fight, right? It's all very exciting. Things are changing. The public are engaged, but they are going to dig down deep, right? The people that have been running things in the civil service.
But don't you get the impression that there are areas where we are winning? And actually, I think this is one of them. The illogicality of net zero and the climate agenda and so on, I think it's now started to come through. I think we're almost at the point where we've won that, certainly, battle of the mind. I spent 6 months of my life standing on roundabouts with holding up yellow boards saying that we don't want 20 mile an hour in my locality. And went to the, and you said about the contempt they hold for us. It went to the environmental committee, and they said 93%, I think it was, of the people surveyed said they didn't want it, and they just voted it through. Absolute contempt. And that you know, you get that all the time. But I do think that on that issue, ULEZ was another one, where I think we have started to win these arguments. Whether we win the battle yet is another matter, but I think we will win the battle in these, just as we did with trans.
That's definitely true for net zero. And although Keir Starmer can't seem to get rid of mad Ed Miliband when he's reshuffle and everything, but it's absolutely become obvious to everyone that net zero is not going to be able to keep the lights on. They know it, right? So they can flannel. You know, it's astonishing that conservatives and others just keep signing things and saying things and not really thinking, how's it? No one actually, it's another theater. It's doing theater, right? How's this going to work? What is this going to mean? How are we going to keep the lights on? How do we get our energy? And you just think, and what's the contribution? Hold on. And none of that conversation. And it's like mad, right? It's mad. And so there's a recognition of that now. And like there's a recognition, is it like, it's a bit like when the whole trans issue came into the public arena and wasn't just dominating institutions. And then the public could look at these activists and see what was going on. And immediately the public was like, hold on, what? And that's why we've tried to bring as much to the public as possible in terms of dialogue and reports and discussions and engagement. A lot of the public have been ahead of everyone, like I say, right, for low traffic neighborhoods and ULEZ and clean air zones in the Midlands and elsewhere. And they've been brilliant people who run local business groups and residence groups. And I'm like, when I met them in different areas, I'm like, you guys could run a council easily. That you really know what you're doing. So there's brilliant people, as we know, that are standing and doing things or doing things independently. And I agree, right? Some of that stuff's going, right? And some of the stuff, the DEI, the ESG, all that stuff that's in the institutions. But the people that are, look, Donald Trump version one got completely hand-tied and stymied. It's why he came back with a vengeance as 2.0, because I think he realized when he was in there, my goodness, you get in, you're meant to hold the most powerful position in the world, and you've got the biggest, like, well, not the biggest, but a very big democracy. And there's this all this lawfare and the DOJ, and it's being weaponized, and you're being cut, and you can't implement the things. So the next time around, he gets a mandate and he starts going bang, 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 and he does it, right? And I think, in a way, it's going to take a. Now, look, I don't agree with everything that's happened, by the way. I mean, we can talk about all that as well, but I like the spirit, and I really love the thing and the mixture of people that have been brought in. And obviously, we're not in America, we're here. But I think that You're absolutely right. There's a sense of a possibility of big change. There's this, what they call this populist moment, but the public are fed up with spin and yes people, and they want to see change, right? And they want people to get on with it. We would encourage them, everyone, to not just think, well, you just do one thing and just vote and then that will just happen. We want people to be more actively engaged in that and ongoing. And though, I think that whilst net zero is very clear, and things like the trans issue, like how that's been activated in various institutions unacceptably, and some of this stuff that's really weaponized race, there are people, and I just think what needs to happen is there needs to be fundamental change. There needs to be a lot of the leaders of the civil service have to go. I think that a lot of the kind of from every, and you know, a lot of what reform is saying, I think, is very sensible on these issues. You know, in terms of cutting back benefits, but getting business to pay more, creating an economy that's dynamic with energy, in you know, security, all these things. And the public, well, the public doesn't want a state to be looking in their bedroom, seeing what they're thinking and eating and doing. What it wants is roads. It wants the borders protected. It wants to make sure it can defend itself. It has to and have a good economy, and then get out. That's it. We don't want to hear anything more. We want to get on with our lives. And I think that that's the thing. But we've had 3 decades of interfering technocrats that are globalists.
Yeah, there's a lot to sweep away, isn't there? I mean, I had this conversation with Mark Littlewood last week. You know, when reform get in, as I'm fairly certain we will, what do we do? And we have to have a plan fully mapped out. And one of the first things is we have to repeal all the Blair legislation which came in. We have effectively to reset the clock back to before 1997. And we had the Supreme Court and all the other things that have messed up our country. And, you know, I think we can do it. And I think if, you know, if I were doing it and, you know, you get a civil servant saying, you know, you can't do that because just a minute, the people have elected me to, you know, on a mandate of doing this, we're going to do it.
That's right. As long as everything's in the manifesto, I think that, you know, 250 heads of the civil service should go, right? And then the rest of them, it should be clear about there's new people, in the same way that Trump did it, in the same way as it happened, Elon Musk did it with X when he went in there, but in the same way Trump did it, he said, I've got a mandate, it doesn't matter about the Paris Accord, right? We're leaving, do what you want, sue us, don't sue us, it's fine, that's what we're doing. And we need to have that be robust, but it has to be democratic, right? So it has to be, and I'm very pleased to see that things like getting rid of the Equalities Act, the Human Rights Act, and even the ECHR, which should have happened, and
the list goes on.
And that's why everyone's trying to make endless more legislation, repealing the majority of it and getting back to some common law based criteria, but then the fundamentals is really essential. Getting rid of IHT for all, I think, as Nigel had said he would do when we did the farmers thing, very important. No digital ID. There must be options to not engage with it and log out, and free speech. These things are essential, not just for people that we like, but for everyone, right? And you know, like I really agree with J.D. Vance about the crisis Europe is facing, but I'm also concerned that with the president, that some of the things that are happening with free speech, right? So, I mean, I think the thing is we can do that in a way in Britain, that because that's about having the authority and the confidence to know you've won, and we can have lots of people saying different things. Words are different to actions. Words are not violence. The Charlie Kirk thing should have shown that to everyone. Violence is violence, and we treat violence differently, and we must uphold our laws, not make endless new ones. But I agree. I think, and you know, I think on things like the economy, on allowing things to fail, but having the potential for investment and infrastructure development, really important. Retraining. I think that there's all sorts of potential for coastal regeneration. I think that food security and family farms, energy security. I mean, people have talked a lot about infrastructure investment, but also nuclear. All these things, they're big things, right? But also, as Nigel pointed out, you could save a lot of money on the net zero spend and the mad spend that's going on, and you can make things work. And also, once you start fully being clear and investing and developing, the dynamism and allowing things to fail. We've had sluggishness. We've had a lack of productivity. We've had low wages. No, you know, and the fact that people could be on benefits and get more than they get paid, it's mental, right? So that all needs to change. And it's good that those things have been put front and center by reform. I would like to see some more of that in the period as we move along, some more of those discussions in terms of some of these areas and the energy and food and the points, as well as repealing. And I think that is, you know, these are all, these things are happening very fast. And we know, like a year and a half ago, it's very different to now. So things are moving quickly. But also, I think people are going to be asking, okay, so how are things going in the councils, right? And I know Zia has said some things, and we talked about a doge. And I know that there's challenges there, right? Because councils, some of them are being obstructed by the permanent employees and not democratically elected. And I get that. But I think it would be very useful for everyone to hear as much as possible from the front line there, what's going on. I mean, obviously, some like Stafford, there's a huge amount of people, like 48 people, right, that have gone in. And that's fantastic, right? But also what people will say, and this is what, I mean, what everyone's going to say, the Conservatives and everyone else, it's all very well in our, when you're in opposition saying things, but how have things gone in these places? So I think a really good audit and a really good clarification of what's happened and what has been achieved and where money's been saved, but where things have been obstructed. I think all those things are important as well. And on it, the public just wants to be told the truth. They want to have people that are honest. The British public, they don't, no more flannelling and spin and like all that. They just want people who are going to just be really honest with them and clear and straight, right? And you can tell bad news. You want to hear the bad news, just hear the bad news, right? And then how, what we're going to do to fix it, right? All those things. So I think if that can be done, which I think it can be, then that will be very positive. And we have to deal with the issues that we've got. And that means a sense that the businesses that are like zombie companies and zombie institutions, they fail and we allow them to fail and we don't get all risk averse and panic stricken. But we also have a bit of an infrastructure for retraining. And we think about all the different areas that we can lead in terms of biomedicine, in terms of electrification and a range, and like more nuclear, more deep sea pursuing of like not just North Sea oil, but a range of other things. We can do all these things that innovate. We're very creative. We led the world with engineering. We should make a kind of great exhibition for towards 3000 and what that means and beyond, and Britain in the next 10, 50, 100, 500 years, leading light for all sorts of new diverse investments and allowing companies to fail and having retraining and have people from around the world think, gosh, I'm going to put my company there, or I'm going to invest there, or at least I'm going to have, not just that we've got a good financial sector and then they want to live elsewhere around the world. We get smart on how we tax things. We get smart on how we have a robust economy. We get smart about who we decide that we're going to bring into this country and not, and why, and that we have a, we do that throughout with our education, across the board with our institutions, and we really kind of transform the situation to get back to some common sense, common values, but a robust dynamic economy that where we have a good environment for entrepreneurs, where the state does its bit for infrastructure but then gets out the way, where we can attract international investment but it's not just globalized, so we have a clarity on what we mean by national development, but as well as like working out that with areas where there's international investment and everything. And I think these things are all very achievable, right? And we've got to say there's going to be some pain. They know that because they know what the problem with the credit situation is and the debt situation, you know, with people. And also, I think there's places that you can save a lot of money. You can shave it, but you're going to have to say, look, we're going to do this and we're going to need this to be addressed. And I, look, the thing about the kids benefit and also the pension cap, the kids benefit, you kind of think to yourself, well, we're benefited out here in Britain, right? And it's like, we got to look at way of making a productive dynamic. And since the 70s, we've been sluggish, if we're honest, right? And we've got to get that dealt with. And I think there's a historic opportunity to do it. And I don't think it can't be squandered. And anyone that goes down the road and get, but then it gets squandered, they'll also be the ones that will be, whatever the analogy is, but you know, they'll also be squandered along with it, because these things need to get addressed. And we could lead the world, right? It sounds so funny saying it again now, because it used to be the case, and it's like, but everyone goes, oh, Britain, what? But we get, you get this right. People talk about Singapore, they talk about what was Hong Kong, they talk about Dubai. People, you know, they've got people that are very, you talk about Mumbai, people talk about different places where things are happening around the world, right? Central Asia, there's all sorts of interesting, exciting things. We should make sure as a global hub that this is true up and down the country, like a dynamic infrastructure, investment, exciting hospitality amongst our other industries. And great farmers, and make, and I utterly believe it's possible. I think, but being honest is important. Saying, look, these parts of these areas will be painful, but we're going to handle that. And when we what used to happen with benefits, it's become a thing. There's a kind of dependency culture. There's an expectation of it. It was only ever meant to be a safety net for a while. And the British working class were very proud. They didn't want to be on charity, right? But we've created a situation that's become very problematic for lots of reasons, right? And other people coming in and taking it as well. And we need to get back to basics, go out, work, be proud in it, apprenticeships and a range of different areas, make things again and like, but also in the service sectors, but really be pioneering. And that's going to take everyone being involved, a kind of manifesto with the public, an engagement with the public and the people, and a real kind of sense that we can do this and lead the way. And I think it's entirely doable. But it will mean that we have to be honest. It will mean that there'll be some pain. It's like being, not having been in the gym for a while, whatever, you know, or whatever the thing may be, not having read for a while, whatever it is, you've got to pick up a kind of habit again and get into it in a decent way, but it's entirely within our grasp.
Right. Let's finish off by coming back to where we started, because you and I met very briefly a week past Sunday at the demonstration in Liverpool at the start of the Labour Party conference against ID cards. And I know this is one of the main things that you're focusing on now. Do you honestly think there is any possibility that any government, whether it's this government or another one, will be able to push through digital ID cards?
I think that they're not going to be able to push through a mandatory digital ID card for everyone to work or to do these things. What is happening and has begun to happen is that there's different areas where digital engagement on an ID is happening, right? So the NHS app, underwritten by Palantir, and if you notice at the Labour Party conference, they talked about NHS digital and how wonderful it could be for everyone, right? Get out to everyone. They're trying to sneak it in the back door with children and younger people, and we need to be conscious of that and deal with it. And they're trying to do it with 8 million directors of companies and saying that if you sign on as a new director in November, you'll have to do it. And then within a year, all the directors will do it. And we've got a big open letter and a petition against that. We'd love people to sign it. And I know people have signed another petition, but the point, what we do is we actually get people to lobby MPs and councillors to actually go and speak to Companies House, to the Small Business Federation, to the CBI, but also Department of Trade and Business and the Cabinet and all sorts of trade organisations and councillors, and say to people in the local elections, where do you stand on this? Because I'm going to vote on the basis of whether you think we should have digital ID or not. And we saw in the last year of council elections, we had farmers and others were all going around to, you know, to rural constituencies, and it had a big impact, right? A lot of people who were in Labour, rural constituencies, they're no longer there. There were lots of reasons for that, but that will happen again. And I think we have a 360 approach to challenge it with press, with campaigning, with lobbying, with protests like we did at the Labour Party conference. They are going to try different mechanisms. They can't do it immediately. Even their proposal document for a Brit card, the group's called Labour Together, the policy group. They kind of changed their name, flattery and all that. But they're saying 2027, and obviously it's got to go to Parliament and it's got to go to the House of Lords. But, you know, there might be an election by that point. Anything could happen. But putting through this different type of infrastructure and trying to force people and all that is really dangerous. And so we're saying there are a number of things that we're doing right now. We're challenging it with the directors. We've got another big thing coming out around what we did with the Together Declaration. Challenge it with children, not allowing it, making clear about what we need. We need health provision. We need proper efficiency. We need resources in the right places. What we don't need is ideology, and we don't need like being told you have to be on a digital biometric state surveillance app, which means you can't even log into the internet or all sorts of other things, or because of the two-tier free speech situation, you might be shut down, or you could be debanked like Nigel was and many others, and you're going to get constantly tracked and surveyed and censored. No, We're not having it. And we'd encourage all of your viewers and all of you at Reform and your colleagues and neighbours and friends and anyone watching and seeing this to get involved together. You may well be a member of Reform. That's great and fine. Many of people are members of Reform and members of Together. We rely on members to keep, to keep campaigning and doing that and to be signatories and to actually harness the ongoing thing about keeping the voice out there, making it done. And I've got to say that, like, for instance, Nigel's been fantastic. He's backed us with things like the farmers, a digital ID, and on low traffic neighborhoods and ULEZ. But we've been out in the trenches doing those things with lots of other people. And often when people didn't really understand what we're talking about, when we're saying no to net zero and a lot of other things like that, and we made it a campaign, notonetzero.uk. And these things that we've been, that's where we've been at the coalface. And we're going to continue to do that with reports, with campaigning, and to make sure we keep Britain free, we take back democracy, and we'd love everyone to be involved with us, togetherdeclaration.org.
Alan, and I know you've got started a wonderful organisation. I know that alongside all the digital stuff you do, all the online stuff you do, you also have meetings, is that right?
Yeah. So we've got our net. In fact, I'm actually going to be debating Labour Together at the Battle of Ideas next weekend. So if anyone wants to be in London, that's usually a really good event. And that's, we've got an event there on the Saturday and the Sunday, on the Saturday with farmers and on the Sunday about digital ID. We have a big national event on November the 16th in London. And then we have a range of events. We've got Wales, Scotland again, and we're going to be doing the Northeast and the Northwest and something down in Sussex. So look out for the dates. You can see on togetherdeclaration.org and at TogetherDec on X. We'd love people to be involved.
I'll put all the links in the show notes to the podcast so people can go and link directly to it. In summary, you started what has turned out to be a fantastic organization. And I do think that in so many of the areas we've discussed tonight, that both Together and Reform are moving in the same direction, almost in lockstep. Maybe there'll be nuances and differences and so on, but we're not far apart in terms of the direction of travel and where we're going. And I think it's good that we have more than one lane. You know, it's not just a political party, that we have groups like yourselves and others like Free Speech Union. And I was involved briefly with Stand in the Park. I don't know if you know of it. There's all sorts of organizations, grassroots organizations, which came out of the tyranny of the COVID period. And I think it's great.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Ken. And yeah, I agree with you. So good. Here's to changing Britain and making sure we get it back together.
Thanks very much for your time, Alan. And once this will work, I think probably on Monday, and I'll send you a link so you can watch it.
Great. And then we'll put it out everywhere. Thanks a lot, Ken. All the best. I'll speak to you soon.